Good way to cop a resentment. You ought to say, I just met him a few minutes ago, so I know he has lots of charm, personality, intelligence, wit, and humility. I was at a meeting Monday, Saturday last week, anyway, and a gal named Sonny was chairing it, and she picked the topic. This is at the other group. And she said her topic was going to be honesty. And Sonny's real sharp, and she says, so do we have a Mr. Honesty who is here who could give us an introduction to the topic? And I said, if I weren't also Mr. Humility, I'd answer that for you. And they all kind of threw up. Harry's heard this, but he can hear it again because he doesn't hear me too well anyway. The story I'm about to tell you, it happens in Italy, where everybody's Catholic almost. So everybody's logically going to head to Rome. Now, if it happened in Oklahoma, where most people are Baptist, people would head to Nashville. And when I said that, people laughed because they think of country western music, but that's where the world headquarters of the Sunday school branch of the Southern Baptist Church is, and I think the world headquarters, but I'm not too sure on that. That's not my church. But anyway, Italy is shaped like a boot, if you don't know that. And this priest comes out from the toe part one day, and he's making just house calls. And he's walking around, and he happens to look up. And he's astounded, because the clouds have a strange movement. They're going around in circles, but not like tornadoes. And in very dimly, in the middle of these clouds, he can see the picture of Jesus coming back. And he goes pounding on doors, and he starts saying, the Lord, he's a come, come a see, and pulling the people out and pointing up. And you know how Italians are, they're not exactly the, I'm a Polak, so, you know, just, well, I'm not being racial in this sense. You gotta tell it this way. You know, they're very emotional people. So they all come out, you know, and they're looking, and they get immediately excited, and they start heading toward Rome. And town by town, they're looking up, and the clouds are swirling more and more. And the image of Jesus is getting clearer and clearer, and this priest is getting more excited, and they finally hit Rome, and there's 4 million of them. They flood into the Vatican Plaza, and this priest goes tearing into St. Peter's, and he knows where the papal apartments are. He goes running right up. He doesn't give a hoot for the papal guard, the Swiss guard. He goes running right into the papal apartment, and he past the secretary, grabs the Holy Father, and he says, Papa, Papa, come and see the Lord. He's a come. And he pulls him out on the balcony, and the Holy Father looks up. And you can't miss it. I mean, now the clouds are dark. And inside this brilliant white image of Jesus coming back. And the Pope takes one look, and he goes back into his apartment, goes over to his desk, gets a sheet of paper out, sits down, and starts writing. And the priest is flabbergasted. He says, Holy Father, what do you do? The Lord is to come, don't you see? Don't you believe? And the Holy Father says, I know, look a busy. Is that what we're doing tonight? You know, are we just here to look busy in AA? Because I know a lot of times that's all I've done. And I know a lot of people who basically that's all they do, go to an AA meeting. Look busy, you know, get your paper signed. And I'm not knocking that. Please, there's no insult involved in this. But I'm talking, I want to tell you why I'm here tonight. And in order for you to understand why I'm here tonight, I'm going to tell you that I have the honor right now of sponsoring someone new, relatively new. And he's working in a detox center. And he has less than 6 months, and he's really never done a fourth and fifth step in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, as I do with almost everybody, I start sponsoring. I tell them what we're going to do is we're going to work up to the fourth step. We'll spend a week at least on the first step. And then another week on the second step, and then another week on the third step. We'll go back and do the basics. And I said, what I'd like you to do is I want you to think about what the first step means to you. What does it really mean to you to be powerless? And what does it really mean to you to be unmanageable? To have a life that's unmanageable? And he called me yesterday, and he said that the answers were so simple. So I said, well, what are they? You know, he wondered. He said, I need better instructions than this. The question, the answer is so obvious. I said, well, what does it mean to you to be powerless? And he says, well, it's real simple. When I start drinking, I have no control over what I'm going to drink. And I said, that's not what powerless means. At least that's not what the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says powerless means. That's not the more, you're missing the more important part of being powerless. And I said, go back and read the book. I guess I got right off into my story. I don't think I gave my name, did I? I'm Larry Kowalski, and I'm an alcoholic. Because the program works, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or a mood change in chemical today, or any today since May the 21st, 1972. And as Ira reminded me, I've just been sober. I've had the honor of just over 20 years. And I was honored to be here in uniform about 6 months into my sobriety. I ceased to use my title to wear my uniform in the program because we had a Colonel John in Lawton until he got drunk and came back as John. And I hope I've learned the lesson from him. And for years now, you know, just this is what I am is what I am. I may take my coat off. I'm wearing a coat because when I was 10 years sober, I spoke in my sponsor's home group. And I spoke, got behind the podium in a t-shirt and jeans. And my sponsor threw me against the wall. My sponsor's Otto. Otto is no respecter of persons at all. He has no sympathy for how thin-skinned I am. And from that day to this day, I wear a coat and tie when I talk. And I had the honor of talking at a regional, multi-state regional Narcotics Anonymous conference. It was about 5 years ago in Cheyenne. Now in NA, if you don't have a tattoo, you're deprived. And formal dress is a tank top. I mean, we're a very different breed of people, that part of me from the alcoholic part of me. And, you know, there are differences. People talk that there are similarities, great ones, but there also are differences. And the best, and this is true for many of them, the best description I've ever heard of the differences between an addict and an alcoholic is, an alcoholic is someone who will drive through three red lights, and an addict is someone who will sit through three green lights. And I sponsor an addict who has 14 years sober, and that's how he got into the program of NA. He was in pre-release and got out and thought he could drink some beer and drank the beer and started doing his pills, and he was in Enid, and he sat through three green lights. That's exactly what he did. He was admiring the light show. Wow! He was just going off all the time. Anyway, I don't even know how I got into that one. I'll come back to what I'm talking about. I asked him, basically, what powerless means, and he gave an answer that I think most people in AA would give. But as I shared with you, it's not the important part of being powerless according to the big book. And also, I may be a little bit solemn today. I'm one of the alcoholics who, with my sponsor's permission, have been going to therapy for about 4 years now. I drive to a therapist in Lawton because she is helping me speed up the process of the steps. She doesn't replace my program. I'm very proud to say in the last 6 weeks, I have made more meetings I've ever made in my life. I have a deeper sense of the importance of the program and everything else. But I go to a men's group, and we're mostly professional men. And I just thought about this as I sat down here. We had a very draining meeting tonight. We had two professionals basically cry, open up for the first time. And the first one cried because this is near the anniversary of when he lost a baby about 9 years ago. They buried the baby today, 9 years ago, and the child was 9 days old when the child died. And he also had a best friend die in Vietnam. And he's never been able to tell anybody at all. No one. He can't talk about Vietnam at home, and he can't talk about his child at home. And then, after him, another professional started opening up, and he started crying too. And what makes me heavy is, see, these people have unmanageable lives, and so did I. But today, they don't have the answer that I do. And I have my answer because of what, at the time, was a curse and since has become a blessing. I've got my answer because I'm an alcoholic. And my being an alcoholic has introduced me to an answer that allows me to have serenity in the midst of pain. And I wish I could just sit in a group of men and reach inside one of those guys or tell them, this is what you got to do. You know, why don't you just do a first step and say you're powerless over this, and do a second step and believe there's an answer, and do a third step and surrender to that answer. And then take all your pain and write it out. And they wouldn't do it. Because you see, it isn't life or death for them. And that's what it was for many of us. We literally thought that if we didn't write, we were going to go back to drinking, go back to that living death, and then the dead death. And there's no way I could really convince somebody who has never been able to share almost any of his experiences, and these aren't the deep things. These aren't like stealing every cent from the poor fund the way I did. This isn't like, you know, just tearing your mother apart and ripping her to shreds. This isn't like hanging up the phone on a suicidal person at 3 o'clock in the morning because I needed to drink. This isn't like the kind of things I did because of my drinking. Some of the heavier things, and I'm mentioning the easier ones that I can mention in public. This is an easy thing that, I mean, it's just an emotional thing, but they don't have answers. They don't have a solution, and I've got a solution. And I've got the solution because I'm an alcoholic. Now let me go on to part two a moment. Because every one of us here, Al-Anon and AA, basically have lives that are unmanageable. And the way I will tell you how I know my life is unmanageable, and this will be different from your understanding, but this is the one that's so important to me. The single most important thing in my family was getting good grades, getting to college, and becoming a professional. All of my grandparents were born in Europe. They spoke, two of them Polish, the other two White Russian. They never learned to speak English. My mother quit school in the fourth grade and started working in a factory in the fourth grade. Child labor laws weren't passed then. My dad quit school in the 11th grade, worked his whole life in the mines until he died in a mine accident in 1958, my senior year at Penn State. And my parents wanted more for their children out of life than they saw from their own horizons. And they thought the key to that was good grades in college. And so when I went into first grade ended without any debate. I never had a choice on it with a college diploma. And I achieved every value my family thought was important. I just will tell you this with no bragging, because it's why I know I'm unmanageable. I've got 400 and some college credits. That's like about 10, 11 years, almost all straight A's. I graduated second in my college at Penn State University, the College of Liberal Arts. I got my diploma personally. I graduated from my college, getting the diploma from the president. When I graduated from Penn State, I had 7 or 8 graduate fellowship offers. I accepted 2 of those and an honorary 3rd one. I then went on and I became a priest, which was the most respected profession where I grew up. I grew up in a Polish ghetto, and it is like 5 times more honored than doctors. This is the Catholic section of Pennsylvania. I had more wealth than anybody in my family, with one exception. I had more status, I had more education, I had every single thing I thought was important. And I needed to drink. See, I just didn't need to drink when I did the stupid things in life. I know my life isn't manageable because when I had it all, when I achieved every dream I had, I still needed to drink, which means when I put the best I can into my life, it's not enough. Harry and I are very, very close friends. We've had basically the better part of 7 years sitting across the table every Monday night. We never had more than 20. We usually had about 12 in the surreal group. And when I first started going there, and Harry knows all this, Vi and I just couldn't stand his damn guts at all. Just at all. I'd fume, or Vi would fume all the way back to Sterling. And, this is the big book says there's a camaraderie with Harry. And it's a very full one. I knew Nolan, of course, very well, and Joe. But Harry, the deepest of all of them. We share a common peril and we share a common solution. And I've learned that if I listen well, Harry says things that are true wisdom. And Harry once said he was one of these people who didn't think he was screwed up when he was drinking. But he said it occurred to him one day, if I felt so good, why did I want to change it with alcohol? And that's a deep question. If when I had every dream I've ever dreamt, why did I need to change it with alcohol? And that's the second part of the first step for me. I can't manage my own life. When I try my best, when I do my best, when I achieve the best I can, I still have to drink. Now, there's reasons for that. And just to help the Al-Anons identify, they came out of my therapy. I discovered that in my childhood, I was nearly absolutely emotionally abandoned. My mother was a dominating woman, so my dad was gone all the time, and he emotionally abandoned me. I had one talk that I remember with my dad. He tried to give us a sex talk, but it was silly. You need one. But I had, the only other talk was the summer before he died in the mine. He told me why he wanted me to go to college, and it was so I would be free to do what I wanted to do. But that's the only talk he ever had with me. I don't ever remember him saying he loved me. I don't ever remember him taking me places, maybe three or four places. I went back to Pennsylvania about three summers ago, and it's fascinating how important my dad is because I never got there. The only places I remember in that state are the places I did, the few things I did with my dad. I remember a state park where my dad took me and my sister. I remember going deep sea fishing once on August 15th with my dad. I remember a very few isolated things like this, but basically, he was never there. He never taught me to do anything. My mother was a workaholic, like a real Al-Anon, except she's got the alcoholic personality. She was a compulsive cleaner, and she pushed us out in the backyard so that she'd get the house clean for us, except because she was a workaholic, she never got the house clean for us. So she never had time for me at all. I don't ever remember my mother telling me she loved me until I came into the program and started telling her that. And it took about 5 years of saying it on the phone before she said it once. And it was like the hardest thing in the world to say. But she's never had a gut talk with me. She's never opened up any feelings, and I don't feel free to talk with her. Out in the backyard was my brother, older, whose love I took. I was my mother's favorite, and so he didn't like me. And he got my younger sister as his ally. And he really was cruel to me, and my choices were be with him and be hurt, or find a place to hide and be alone. And I found a place to hide. And there was nobody my age in the neighborhood. And I lived outside a ghetto, a literal ghetto, and I went to school inside that Polish ghetto. And almost every other kid in my class lived in the ghetto, and they grew up and they walked the streets together. And nobody paid any attention to me. I didn't have anybody show any interest in being a friend of mine until I was a freshman and sophomore in high school. So when I say I'm nearly totally emotionally abandoned, I mean it. Nobody gave a damn except for two women who were friends of my mother's. And one was kind of emotionally draining, and the other is the only real supporting person I had. And she was gentle and she was always there, but she wasn't there often. She was always basically present. So I know why I hurt inside. You know, I'm so many of us. The single trait that just, I believe, every Al-Anon will have, I was listening to a therapist, Terry Gorski, who's in all of our programs, talk. And he talks about the codependent and the counterdependent, and Al-Anons are all codependent. That's part of my personality I share with him. And he says that the gut root, the single biggest fear that we have, is a desperate fear of abandonment. And I'm just walking through a lot of heavy stuff this week. Because I was abandoned by someone who has sort of a mother image for me. She didn't come to my 20th AA celebration. And I've been going crazy over it, obsessing about it. And I know I'm way overreacting. And sharing with this therapist, she told me why. It's playing back. Your mother never being there. And it's opening that scab in the pain. Well, I've got a lot of inner pain. On top of this, I felt ugly. I didn't, I've never felt wanted. You know, I felt different. I felt other. I felt clumsy. I never thought I was athletic. Didn't know how to do anything. And the only area of my life where anything ever happened good was from junior high school on, I started doing okay in school. I was a C student in grammar school, a B student in junior high, an A, B student in high school, as I told you, an A student in college. But life really began somewhere around the age of 16. You know, I can tell you where the bar is in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. That's where I grew up. Coal mining town in northeastern Pennsylvania. That's where me and my friends started drinking. And alcohol, hey, it worked. All of a sudden, I could manage my life. See, without alcohol, my life's unmanageable. With alcohol, I managed my life. With alcohol, I could be friendly. With alcohol, I could be social. With alcohol, I could laugh. With alcohol, I could confront people. With alcohol, I could be angry. With alcohol, I could be the life of the party. With alcohol, I could talk to a group. With alcohol, I could talk to a couple. With alcohol, I could counsel an individual. Alcohol was the answer to my alcoholism. It does something for me. And that's very important for me to know. I thought it happened to everybody. I didn't know that it doesn't do this to Al-Anon. Clancy says it better than anybody in the world. You know, if Harry's wife and I, 18 years ago, were, better not be, or I'm lying about my sobriety, 21 years ago, if we went out to celebrate Harry, no, Harry's not been in AA, so, but Ira's wife, we went out to celebrate his coming into AA, and she and I both had a drink. Clancy said, that goes down, and it hits my stomach, and it goes, and it does. Life begins. She takes a drink, and it goes down, and goes, whoop. Notice now, it did something. And if you have one of these little sound meters, and you get enough clips, you're going to get an explosion, and you'll be legally drunk. So Al-Anon, on New Year's Eve, he got picked up for being drunken drivers. But normally, there's a world of difference in the reaction. And I was on a program once with an Al-Anon, and we were talking about this. I talked about, I listened to her so carefully. And she had smashed a car, and she was all nervous. And she sat down and she had two drinks so she could handle the accident. And, hey, I knew what was different. When I was 26, I bought my first car, a Volkswagen Bug. And I had it about a year and a half, and I was on my way to Ocean City, Maryland. And I ran what I thought was going to be an orange light, and it went red. And I had an argument. My Volkswagen had an argument with a Ford, and it ended up looking like an accordion. And that was my first big accident. And I sent out for a bottle, and that was the answer. See, she took some drinks to help her walk through the answer. When I took the drink, that was the answer. And that's the difference. It's okay. The car smashed, what the hell? I'm okay. And that's the difference of what alcohol does for me. Alcohol is my solution. I've shared this before. I could do the first three steps. That's what I've been doing with you. I came to believe that I was powerless over my sobriety, that my life was unmanageable. I couldn't live sober. It's terrible. Well, I admit it, I was powerless over. I came to believe that a power greater than myself, alcohol, could restore me to sanity. I had total faith in that bottle when I set out for it. And the neat thing for me that day is alcohol proved my faith. I made a conscious decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of alcohol. And that day, alcohol took care of me. Now, see, those of you who are Al-Anon can't understand that. It's never been that power in your life. It's been nice, but it's been our answer. I drank everything I could. I remember getting a tingle. My first drinking was some of the best I ever had. I would have alcohol course through my system, and listening in NA, it did for me what heroin, the rushes heroin did for some heroin addicts later. I got a rush. If I closed my eyes, every cell in my body tingled, and it felt so damn good I couldn't even stand. And that was great. And life was okay. I was okay. The world was still the same. Now, I was still 16, 17, and the legal age in Pennsylvania was 21. We didn't have a lot of money. I went away to Penn State. I graduated at the age of 20 simply because I started school early. I never skipped a grade. But I was never able to take a legal drink at Penn State. And they were pretty strict. So the only places I could drink was fraternity parties. And I'm going to tell you, I never turned down a drink. As a matter of fact, I didn't even wait to be offered. I took every drink I could get. And if I didn't always get drunk, it's because I couldn't get enough under these circumstances on this occasion to get drunk. I was never upset by blackouts. I remember my first blackout. It was a frat party at Penn State. My best friend had come in from Franklin and Marshall College, and I was showing him some of the frat. And some gross things happened. I was the last one down in the cellar of this fraternity where we were drinking, and I emptied the pitcher, and then I filled it and walked away. Then I try to get into a car through the back window, and the next thing I remember, I was standing in the men's room in my dorm at Penn State shouting, "Gotta pardon it, it's Penn State vocabulary, help, I'm sterile, I can't piss." And the period in between, they tell me we visited yet another frat party. Everything, that was my first blackout. Never upset me. I was never upset by a single blackout in my life. They were just memories I didn't have to worry about. Graduated from Penn State, and then I was working as a waiter in the Poconos, that's the Catskills as they run through Pennsylvania, and my first legal drinks, and they thought they were pulling a wise one on me. I worked there, went into the bar, and they gave me two Boilermakers. So they gave me a Boilermaker. And they thought I couldn't tell it. I mean, I wasn't going to complain because this was free booze. They were on the house, and then they gave me another one, and that was equally great. Then I graduated from Penn State, and I started school at the University of Wisconsin. I'm going to watch this real closely. About 3 years ago, I spoke in Bartlesville, and I started thinking of my life and all the schools I've been in. And I was going to talk, and I'm going to tell you, I did a semester of graduate work in the field of political science under the top expert in the field I love, constitutional law, in the world. And the only thing I can tell you about Madison, Wisconsin is, for the first time in my life, I could drink legally. I could tell you where the bar was that I drank, the steins of beer that I had, and my discovery of wine coolers. And all I could do from every school I was in is give you drinking experiences. And I'm going to bet that if you took an Al-Anon through 11 years of college and asked her what her memories are, the only thing she would remember were not the memories of drinking. But I can tell you why those are the memories I have. Because the mind rejects what is unpleasant. It's built into the mind. We push it down. And the mind keeps what is pleasant. And my non-painful memories were the memories when I drank. If you're new, you're the one I'm talking to tonight, you'll hear people tell you you're a problem drinker. That's right, that ain't right. If you're like me, you came here because drinking's causing you a problem. But if you're like me, on a deeper level of your mind, you know there's something wrong with that, because drinking ain't the problem, drinking's the answer. Go back far enough, and the only times there aren't problems are the times when alcohol is there. And then what happened to me? It got out of control. Well, yeah, no problem with that. I'll come back to this guy's sponsor in a moment. Alcohol worked. That's the first thing about my being an alcoholic that I can share with Harry. Then it got out of control. That's the second thing. No big sweat. You know, it's like having sex get out of control. The people don't complain about it too much right away. It's just you enjoy it. I really didn't mind not having control. But the third thing happened. And it's when the four horsemen sink settled in. Alcohol stopped working. I drank. And all of a sudden, it wasn't my solution anymore. I felt more abandoned drunk than I did sober. And I know that because of how I drank. See, alcohol, now this, drugs don't work the same for everybody. Let me again give you two differences in my life between alcohol and street drugs. When I took a drink, alcohol was a bridge from me to you. It's like, I'm here, I'm alone, I'm isolated. I drink, and there's a bridge right to you. When I did my street drugs, I would do them at a party, but it's like I pulled the mode up. Because when I did street drugs, it was so good in my head, I didn't want to talk to you. Because I didn't want to get out of the goodness in the head to have to be part of the world. So for me, drugs made me unsocial, right from the start. Not antisocial, but just unsocial. Let me stay here. Alcohol made me social. But when alcohol stopped, well, I did my drinking, been to the Purple Bunny Club in Lawton. I'm the only one. See, you gotta have been there a long time ago. Lawton had a Purple Bunny Club not very far from where Eisenhower High School is. And I did a hell of a lot of drinking there. Now, that's because I'm such a nice guy. We had all these vets. I bought this. This is all lies, but the rationalizations, I believe. We had all these vets coming back from Vietnam. And they had problems, and they needed to talk, and they would want to talk to me. And I thought if I brought them into the cold atmosphere of a church house, it would be so much more difficult for them to talk. So let's go to someplace nice and warm and friendly, like the Purple Bunny Club in Lawton. And I didn't want to give a scandal, so I wore sunglasses and a green suit. And they would scream their problems at me over the sets of music. Well, that's where I did a lot of my drinking. I did my drinking in public. Then all of a sudden, I wasn't drinking in public, and nobody said anything there. I started drinking at home. And then I was drinking upstairs, and then I was drinking upstairs with the doors closed and the shades down. And I was more unsocial than I had ever been before in my life. Alcohol wasn't working. At this point, the thing I hope the person I'm sponsoring will see comes out. The important thing in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that most of us miss when we're new is not that when we take a drink we're powerless. The thing the Big Book stresses three or four times and puts in italics twice is, I'm powerless over the first drink. Because my life is unmanageable. Clancy does it like this, and it's a good instance. I start drinking an alcohol-caused drink. I got the shakes at communion time one Sunday. And it was when we were still putting the host in everybody's mouth. And as I phrase it, I couldn't have put it in the Holland Tunnel that day. And the thing that got me out of trouble is I've always been a glib liar. So I went up to the microphone and said, I just got hit by the flu bug. I'm all shaky. Go get the pastor. And they did. Two things resulted from that. The next Sunday, I got a lot of sympathy. And I always take sympathy, whether it's honest or not. And from then on, I couldn't be drunk on Sundays, but I couldn't shake. So from then on Sundays until I came into the program, I was so bombed on tranquilizers, the way I put it is if you had put an A-bomb off in town, I wasn't going to shake. I was calm, and I mean that I was calm on Sunday. And if you notice my hand shaking now, it's not from drinking. I have a familial tremor in my right hand, and it's starting slowly in my left. It's just, I thought it was Parkinson's because they think my mother has it, but it isn't. It's the opposite. I just got to shake. And that's all. But back then, the last 3 years of my drinking, I never ordered soup. I'd still be at the table between the plate and the mouth. The spoon was empty from the shake. It gone all the time. So alcohol had stopped working, but it caused pain. And I would remember the problems it was getting me into. Exploding at parties, having fights with friends, ruining relationships, blabbing secrets told to me in counseling. Telling them to the world and ruining things. And I got so ashamed that with alcohol did I stop drinking. The pain of drinking got so bad I stopped. And then instantly the pain of sobriety started. And it's like the longer I was sober, the more painful sobriety got. Because I couldn't manage my life. Doing the best I can, I got a hole in who I am. Until this tipped it over and I started drinking again. And then the drinking caused the pain and I was going this way. So the important thing that this guy in Lawton needs to know is, I'm powerless over the first drink. See, again, Clancy says it so well. If you can't control your drinking, meaning that when you take a drink, you can't guarantee what you're going to do, there's a simple solution. Don't drink. You know, if when you take the first drink, you're powerless. Well, don't take the first drink. It's just that simple. Why am I here and why do I think most of you are here? Because after we learned this, we found ourselves picking up the first drink. And that all of a sudden turns around what's happening here today. I'm not just looking busy anymore. I didn't tell Ira this. Somebody said something up in the Capitol Hill Club that the longer you're sober, the richer it will be. Imagine if you had not quit drinking the day you came to AA, and you were not lucky enough to be in the penitentiary or die, where would you be today? It just gets worse. And we don't die. That is one of the mistruths we tell newcomers, keep drinking, you're going to die. Well, again, I'm going to quote Clancy, because he's the only person I've ever heard say this. He said, that's exactly what most newcomers need to hear. And I will tell you, if you could have guaranteed me I'd be dead in a week, I'd have said, thank God, and I've gone right out and finished drinking. Because I didn't want to live in the pain I was in when I came here. Clancy says, you tell him the truth. And if you want to see if I'm telling the truth, you go down to the Salvation Army in Lawton, or if you have a mission here, you go down to the mission, and you take a hard look. Alcohol doesn't kill. The lucky ones in the program who go out die quickly, and there are a few who do. Most of them live 10 to 15 to 20 to 25 years, and they pick up a hell they would have been in if they had never stopped, and it just gets worse. And when I heard Clancy say that, I was 3 years sober and my stomach turned. Now that's the one alternative. Where would I be? And the good phrase, where the hell? Because hell to me is the absence of love, because my God is love. Where the hell would I be with 20 more years of drinking? And when I think of that as the alternative, I've got a heaven of a lot to be grateful for here in the program. Because I found fellowship. I really like Harry. Crazy as he is, I like him. You know, we need to know this. The hardest of men are men in the program. Oh, you might know that Harry might have a temper. Well, he was our treasurer. And we always had a lot of money in Truro because we had no expenses except for birthday cakes. And the birthday cakes were brought in Sterling. We would bring them up. And the guy whose mother baked them was with us. He was part of our group. And we had just taken up the collection, and Harry had like $15 bills in his hand this day. And I'm there, and I asked this guy, how much is this cake? And he says $11. And Harry is talking to somebody, and he has all this money in his hand. I go right over, and I rip the money out of his hand. And give it to this other guy. Needless to say, we had an altercation. For which we both made amends, and he shouldn't have, because he did nothing but what was human. And I did what was wrong. I couldn't say anything. I mean, just, it's one of the ways I act sometimes when I'm not being very personal or human. But the very first part of AA is fellowship. And I really do have fellowship, because I understand his disease. He's shared enough that I know that he's got my disease, and I hope he knows I've got his disease. And then, secondly, this is on the start of chapter 2, there is a solution. We have a common peril, and we've got a common solution. We really have tried this common solution, and we try it together. The fact that we would more work amends on each other proves we're still trying to work that program together. As a matter of fact, the embarrassing thing is he called me long distance to make amends that I owed to him. But he's a neater guy like that than I am. He's not as screwed up as I am. It started with fellowship, but then it leads to recovery. Because you see, fellowship doesn't plug the hole in the gut. Fellowship doesn't make my life manageable. The first 10 steps get rid of all this crap. That's their basic purpose. 1, 2, and 3 keep alcohol out, because I can't touch the alcoholism when I'm drinking. And it just is reality. The fourth step is learning to look at myself. And I can't look at myself when I'm drugged to myself. That's so simple, it doesn't, you know, just, oh, I've got to tell you a story. Fourth step is ask. This step is, I have the freedom to be myself. I tell one person everything I am, all these dark secrets, and he listens, and I since have had the freedom to be me. The sixth step then is wanting to be the full person that I am. And I had this very brilliant story on the seventh step. I love a good steak. I had one tonight. Last time you told this, you crapped it up. the best thing I've ever heard on the seven-step Terry Toad, and I can tell it better than he can now because he's forgetting us. This is his story. He loves a good steak, and he had one good molar that he needed left to really enjoy a good steak, and it wasn't feeling right. So he goes to see a dentist. And the dentist says, now I'm going to put it in program terms, your molar has a defect of character. It needs to be removed entirely. And Harry says, I'm not entirely ready to have that molar removed. No, thank you. And Harry goes home. At which point, an infection sets in the tooth, so that, as Harry told us, he could feel his heartbeat in his tooth. And when the dentist opened, Harry was there entirely ready to have that dentist remove that defect of character. However, the dentist opened his mouth and took one look, and he says, you got an infection. Closed Harry's mouth, gave him some pills, and said, take these pills and come back in 3 days. Now, you pay attention, because this is the whole story you told. This is the neatest thing I've heard. 3 days later, it's still throbbing. Harry goes back to see him. Wasn't throbbing as badly. The dentist opens the mouth, says, still infected, closes the mouth, take these pills, come back in 3 days. 3 days later, the tooth wasn't hurting. Now, that's where Harry's story and I part company, because I wouldn't have gone back to the damn dentist for my defective character. It ain't hurting now. Let's keep it for a while. We can enjoy it some more. There's still steaks down the line. But Harry went back to the dentist, who opened his mouth and removed the tooth. And Harry said, and I've never heard anything as neat, you wonder why when you reach the seventh step and you humbly ask God to remove a defect, it doesn't get removed? Because God knows there's some emotional or psychological or intellectual infection, and God says, take this meeting and come back in 3 days. Now, you'll never hear anything better than that, and that's from him. That's really tremendous. The eighth and ninth step help me become aware of you, that you're in my world. The tenth step keeps it all going. But now hear this. All that did was get rid of the pain. It doesn't fill the hole. And the 11th step does that. And that's the step so few people are doing anymore, real meditation. People are reading the books. But the step doesn't say, read the 24-hour, and deplete, I'm not attacking, but the step doesn't say, stop through prayer and meditation to know what ODAT says, or any of the others. It says, stop through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. And that's what this step is. And my conscious contact with God, my God is a God of love. Now, this is just me. And love doesn't come from my reading thoughts. As a matter of fact, the big book says, philosophy and ethics didn't do it for us. It doesn't plug the hole in the gap, in the gut. That's in the big book. And that's what a lot of people think meditation is. Reading some nice thought, that's philosophy, or some good rule for living, that's ethics. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. What a privileged group of people we are. You know, you see Al-Anon living with drinking alcoholics, and they have peace in their eyes. If you want to know if someone has conscious contact with God, I would say first look in their eyes and see if there's someone home. And the single greatest hurt I get is how many good Christians every Sunday who are making every sacrifice in the world don't have the look. Because they're trying too hard. And how many alcoholics have that look? But I got to sustain it through meditation, because day by day, as soon as I stop meditating, all of a sudden, sobriety starts becoming intolerable. And it does. I have to put myself in the presence of a God who loves me. Just let that God love me. That's my God. My God's a God of love. And I will read the same story. I go to the Bible for my meditations, and I pick a simple story. And I have been on the same story for about 9 months now. You see, the purpose isn't learning. The purpose is experience. I had a church degree in theology when I needed to drink. And I knew a lot about God, but I didn't know God. When God knows me, when I feel the love of my God, I don't want to drink. I don't want to be in any way chemically altered. That's that answer Harry said. If I felt so good, why did I want to change? My meditations aren't emotional. They're not emotional highs. They're very calm, quiet inside. And I've walked through a lot of heavy stuff the last month of my life. I think I heard my God give me some messages at a service. They're putting therapy in its right place. And what came to me was dealing with some of my other addictions right from here. And it was like probably no human power could have relieved this addiction. And then God could, and what if he were soft, and half measures availed us nothing. And three phrases clicked in my head, and a peace came over, and I'm in a new world. I've walked through some abandonment pain since then, but I'm really learning to care. I'm learning to feel, and I'm learning to share. I've had some very nice things happen, like the last 24 hours. I was 54 years old, and I had never cried in my life. Because I remember my mother saying, you cry and I'll give you something to cry about. So I have 54 years of tears stuffed inside. And that's not healthy for anybody. That's how you get ulcers and cancer and strokes. All that pain locked in the inside. I still can't cry over pain, but I cry over love. And I really, the guys at this meeting today went out of their way thanking me because of my program, I was listening to people do some heavy sharing. And other people in this group ask questions, and I do the AA technique. I'll go in and I'll share a similar experience. And I told the one guy how I went to my dad's grave and reclaimed all my memories about 5 years ago. I went to where I grew up. I went to where I went to grammar school. I went to the church inside where I grew up. Went to my high school. Went to where I went 2 years to Penn State. Drove around town, then I went to the grave where my mother's family and my dad are buried. And I gave my dad permission to be dead. And I'm at total peace. I feel my dad's love with me now. And I did this so this guy could make peace. And he had never told anybody about his friend dying in Vietnam because he said, my family doesn't want to hear it. And I says, well, we're a family of yours now. You tell us. And we thanked him because he finally got it out. You know, he's a grown man and a professional crying to get a pain out. Well, see, the old me couldn't get a damn about his thing unless I could manipulate him for something. But I cared about that guy today. A drug addict that I sponsor who has 14 years clean called me on Friday, and they removed a mole. He's having back trouble and went to see the doctor on this, and the doctor saw a mole, and he said, that worries me more. And this guy's sister died from melanoma, and I'm really worried. He thought maybe he'd get the results today or tomorrow, and I hope the word will be there. I'm afraid it's not going to be good news. And I've had a damper on my joy the whole weekend because one of my best friends may have terminal cancer, and then that's upsetting. Well, I'm caring. I'm getting out of myself. And that's a new me. And that leads to the service, the fellowship. Well, Harry and I knew a gal named Vi. She died of cancer. And at one point, when Vi had cancer, and this will be my last set of stories, and I'll shut it down then, Vi needed a shake-up. Vi, I shook her tree twice. When I got to Sterling, she was the only alcoholic there. She had about 7 years, and she wasn't making any meetings. And I walked in to see her, and I said, Vi, I got to tell you something. I'll say it only once, because if I ever bring it up again, and I'll become your excuse for drinking, and I don't want to be that. But I got to tell you that you're setting yourself up for a drunk. You're missing meetings. And you ought to know what happens when alcoholics stop going to meetings. And I said, if I didn't tell you this and you drank, I'd carry some guilt because I didn't say it. Having said it once, I'll never say it again. She started going to meetings and we became such good friends. When she got her cancer, I went over. And this may sound cold, but it was the greatest gift of love I think I gave her. I sat down and I said, well, I got to ask you something. What the hell are you doing to justify the air you're breathing today? When I asked her this, she was in total remission. I said, God's working two miracles in your life today. You're a sober alcoholic, and you should have been dead years ago. And right now, you don't have any cancer. What are you doing with it? You're sitting here feeling sorry for yourself, and there's people out there hurting. You take the gifts you've been given, and you share them with others. I just listened to a tape on the way down here of an AA speaker, a gal named Karen. And the single thing she bubbles over with from start to finish is gratitude. She's so damn grateful and so damn anxious to share it, I could touch it. I didn't want to come talk to you because if you're listening to her, there's nothing I could share that will match what she said. But you see, if I remember that I have no control over the first drink. For 20 years, I've had no say over whether I'll take that first drink. And I haven't taken it. But I ought to be damn grateful I'm not drinking today. And if in order not to take it today, I'm asked to work with another alcoholic, and I'm given the honor of coming to work with another alcoholic, then it should be a real thrill to be down here and share with you. Thank you very much.